Good day. Today is Tuesday, 17th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched and listened to this programme, or whichever part of this programme you want to watch and listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, this morning, the big news, at least the big news in the media, the story that is dominating the media, and up to a point, rightly so, is the claim from Israel that the Israelis, over the course of an overnight strike, managed to kill the secretary of Iran's National Security Council and the person who has been in charge or overall charge of the conduct of the war by Iran, Ali Larijani. Larijani was, of course, the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei's national security advisor. He is the person who apparently was given overall control of the security agencies in Iran by the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, during the protests which took place in January. He is the person who coordinated the suppression of those protests. He is the individual who flew to Moscow in February and met with President Putin and with other Russian officials, and from reports I have heard, also with Chinese officials at the Chinese embassy. We've had very sketchy accounts of that meeting, but all of the information that I have heard suggests that the meetings were extensive and led to all kinds of agreements and arrangements which came into effect the moment the current conflict between Iran, Israel and the United States began. And Larijani also is the person who perhaps masterminded but certainly supervised the conduct of Iran's military response to the American and Israeli attack on Iran, which began on the 28th of February. And Larijani has had an important record in Iran's politics. He is very well connected to various very senior members of Iran's clerical establishment. He's obviously been close to Khamenei in the past. He's been, I believe, the Speaker of Iran's parliament. He's been the chief negotiator in some of the nuclear negotiations between Iran and the United States, which led to the agreement to set up the JCPOA. And, of course, he's had many extensive contacts with the Chinese and with the Russians. So we are indeed talking about a very important, very senior official. But that is not the same as saying that he is an irreplaceable official. And this, in my opinion, has been the mistake that the United States, but Israel especially, have been making in all of their various attempts to destabilize the government of Iran. The belief appears to be in Israel that if they can kill all of the top officials or all the top officials or as many of the top officials of the Iranian government as they can find, this will at some point in some way precipitate the collapse of the Iranian government. We saw that in the first day of the June 2025 12-day war, when Israel successfully tracked down and killed a large number of senior Iranian military and science officials, though not Larijani or Pezeshkian or the supreme leader himself, Ayatollah Khamenei. And we saw this again on the very first day of the current conflict on the 28th of February, when the Israelis launched a powerful missile strike on Khamenei's residence in Tehran, killing Khamenei, several members of his family, including children, and also various other senior officials who were gathered to meet with Khamenei on that particular day. Now, in relation to that particular strike, a recording has now been circulating of a report about that strike that was made by the Iranian authorities themselves, providing an account of what happened over the course of this strike and explaining why Muqtada Khamenei, the current supreme leader, and by the way, apologies for mangling my pronunciation of his name in previous videos. Anyway, how it came about that Muqtada Khamenei survived that attack. He apparently was also present at that residence, in the meeting itself, at the time when the attack was taking place. And the reports say that Muqtada Khamenei, as it happened, left the meeting to walk in the garden of the residence, even as the missiles, the Israeli missiles, struck the residence, killing everybody inside. And he did suffer injuries to his foot, other injuries as well, apparently. The report, the recording says that overall, however, he is in reasonably good condition. There's no word about him being in Moscow, by the way, just to say. But anyway, that he survived the attack. But of course, his father and other top Iranian officials and members of his immediate family did not, including his children. Well, anyway, Larijani himself was not at this meeting. And, well, again, the expectation, perhaps, in Israel and in Washington was that after this devastating strike, which took place on the 28th of February, there might have been an expectation of the opening up of a power vacuum and of a collapse of the Iranian government and of a regime change or of a regime change crisis in Iran. But it didn't happen. And the Israelis have made the same calculation with Hezbollah. They conducted a succession of devastating strikes against Hezbollah in 2024, starting with a pager attack, then with a strike on a meeting of senior Hezbollah officials, including the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, and then a subsequent meeting in which Nasrallah's immediate successor was also killed. Now, of course, in relation to all of the strikes that I've just been talking about, the one in Iran at the start of the June 2025 war, the one that took place in Tehran on the 28th of February, and the strikes against Hezbollah, which took place in the summer of 2024. According to reports and rumours, the Israelis obtained the information about these meetings from the former head of the Quds Special Forces of Iran's IRGC, General Khani, who supposedly has been exposed as a Mossad agent and has been arrested and executed, or perhaps has committed suicide, as discussed in my previous two programs. Anyway, the point is that Hezbollah is now back in operation. Apparently, the Israelis have been surprised that following Israel's own attempts to conduct a ground offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon over the last week or so, and in response to Israeli airstrikes on Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hezbollah has been putting up far more effective resistance than the Israelis expected. And Hezbollah, for its own part, has also conducted missile and rocket strikes against Israel, again, to a greater extent than the Israelis apparently expected. So we see that the decapitation strikes that were carried out by the Israelis against Hezbollah were unsuccessful, and the decapitation strikes that were carried out against the Iranian leadership in 2024 and in 2025 and on the 28th of February of this year have so far been unsuccessful as well. So why think that killing Larijani is going to change the overall picture? We've heard that Iran, anticipating attacks upon itself and a Iranian plan to assassinate its leaders, has decentralized its leadership, has created a mosaic defense organization, that Iranian regional governors have been given wide autonomy by the central Iranian government to make decisions as they see fit. We've seen no evidence that the previous plan of decapitation or assassination has paralyzed the Iranian leadership or led to the collapse of the Iranian government. And we see no evidence that it is causing Iran to reconsider either its military or political approach to this crisis. Iran continues to conduct missile and drone attacks across the Middle East. Iran continues to conduct missile strikes on Israel itself. Iran continues to maintain tight control over the Strait of Hormuz. It seems that even the claim that Iran has lost control of the sky over its territory is only partially true. As I discussed in a recent program, footage that I have seen of American bombers, B-52s, show them carrying JASSMs missiles, which suggests that the ongoing strikes that both Israel and the United States continue to conduct against Iran are conducted from outside Iranian airspace. So I don't see why the assassination, the killing of Larijani and apparently of another senior Iranian official, the head of the Basij militia, is going to make any fundamental difference. In fact, I would go further still. I suspect that the reason that the Israelis were able to find and kill Larijani is because a few days ago, Larijani, together with other prominent Iranian leaders, including Pezeshkian and Araxi participated in big demonstrations which took place in Tehran. They walked together with the various other demonstrators. They made themselves publicly visible. And though the Israelis and the Americans did not attack them then, which was perhaps because any attack on these people at a time when they were surrounded by civilians in the way that they were might have resulted in enormous numbers of civilian casualties, which would have been politically embarrassing. I've stopped, I'm afraid, thinking that inhibitions, that there are moral inhibitions about the deaths of civilians in this conflict. I don't think that enters into the calculus in Israel or Washington at all. I say that with a heavy heart, but it seems to me to be true. Anyway, the fact that Larijani made himself publicly visible in that way would have meant that the Israelis would have known where he was at a particular point in time, and that would have made it much easier for them to track his movements back to wherever it is that he was. And sooner or later, that meant that the Israelis were able to catch up with him. Now, I can't help but wonder whether Larijani himself would have known that in advance, whether he knew when he participated in that big public demonstration that the Israelis would identify him and would be able to establish his location. In that case, more so than Ayatollah Khamenei on the 28th of February, Larijani basically set himself up for death, or as a devout Shia Muslim would presumably say, he himself embraced martyrdom. In which case, that must logically mean that Larijani has already selected his successors, has already picked the apparatus that will continue the campaign once he is gone. Presumably they're all agreed as to the plan and to the approach that will be taken, in which case all that the Israelis have achieved by killing Larijani, if, by the way, he is indeed dead, all that the Israelis will have achieved will have been to gift Iran, or at least the Islamic Republic of Iran, with yet another martyr. So I do not understand the logic of this decapitation strategy. Now, I've touched about my own massive ethical qualms about this, but I must also point to the incredibly ruthless way in which this decapitation strategy is being conducted. Once upon a time, not so long ago, if Western intelligence agencies had identified the presence of civilians in a location where somebody that they were targeting was likely to be, they would have avoided conducting that attack because of the presence of those civilians. That may seem idealistic, but I happen to know it is true. This time, the Americans and the Israelis are showing no such inhibitions. When they attacked Khamenei's residence on the 28th of February, they would have known that Khamenei had his family there, that there would have been wives and children and other people entirely innocent of any political activity. Khamenei's granddaughter, for example, who was only 2 years old, that they would all have been there, with a high probability that they would have been killed as well. And yet, the decision was nonetheless made to conduct the strike and to carry out the killings. I have to say that this type of ruthlessness shocks me. Now, I don't know whether there were any civilians with Larijani when he was killed. I would like to believe that there were none. But I have to say, based on everything that has been going on in this conflict up to this time, that if there were, I doubt that it would have made any difference. Just saying. Anyway, there it is. That's all I'm going to say about Larijani up to this point. I fully expect that there will be someone else to take his place. I don't see that this is going to change the calculus of the war. The calculus of the war remains exactly the same as it was previous to his death. In fact, if anything, my guess, and it is only a guess, is that his death will further harden the leadership in Iran. It will mean that younger people will take over. Larijani himself was 67, just say. That people perhaps more trusted by the Iranian leadership will be in overall control. Larijani seems to have been a deeply committed official, a loyal servant of the Islamic Republic. But on two occasions, the clerical leadership rejected his bid to stand for president of Iran, something which has never been fully explained, but which suggests that there were doubts about him and that there were criticisms of him within the high reaches of Iran's leadership. Anyway, it's likely that we're going to have a younger, tougher, more hardline leadership as the veterans who formed their views during the Iranian Revolution of the 1970s and during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s are replaced by younger leaders who perceive the world through the framework of the conflict, Iran's conflict with Israel and the United States. Anyway, that's where I think we are at the present time. I'm not going to say very much more about this. So nothing, in my opinion, of substance decisively has changed. The key thing that continues to happen, the two key things that continue to happen, is that the energy prices continue to rise. This morning, they were trading, oil was trading at well above $100 a barrel, just saying. And that the Iranians continue to maintain their very tight control of the Strait of Hormuz, letting only ships that they agreed to pass through, The Gulf monarchies are increasingly feeling betrayed and abandoned by the United States. There are now increasing comments and commentaries from senior citizens of the Gulf states. So far, the governments themselves have not joined, but more and more of them are asking, where was the protection from the United States that they were promised? Why were they catapulted into a war, which was none of their choice? Why is it that it is their cities and their communities and their energy complexes that are being targeted and which the Americans are unable to protect? Why is it that the United States, despite its overwhelming power, or what they were repeatedly told was its overwhelming power, seems unable to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Anyway, the Gulf states appear to be going through a crisis of confidence in the United States, which is deepening. I get the sense that this is starting to happen in the energy markets as well. And for the record, I don't see that the military campaign against Iran, contrary to what Pete Hegseth and others are saying, is making any kind of progress at all. And the Iranians, for their part, continue to reject all proposals for a ceasefire, all proposals for negotiations. The Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, one does wonder how long it will be before the Israelis come after him, by the way. Anyway, the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has refuted stories that were circulating in the media yesterday, which I assume had their origins from within the administration, that Araghchi was in text contact with Steve Witkoff. Araghchi said that he has no interest in talking or communicating to Witkoff at all, that he feels that he and Iran were deceived by Witkoff, and he's not interested, and Iran is not interested in a ceasefire or in negotiations or any of that sort of thing. So it seems to me that the calculus of all of that has not changed up to now at all. Just say. Now, on the American side, we are starting to see the first public signs of dissent. Joe Kent, director of the US's National Counterterrorism Center, has now announced his resignation. And this is what he says, as I'm reading this from his post on X. After much reflection, I have decided to resign from my position as director of the National Counterterrorism Center, effective today. I cannot, in good conscience, support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. It has been an honor serving under the President of the United States and DNI Gabbard and leading the professionals at NCTC. May God bless America. Now, Joe Kent is the first resignation that I know of. Maybe we will be seeing others, but for the moment at least, there is no sign of any concerted attempt to force open the Strait of Hormuz. The US Navy, according to reports and apparently satellite sightings, is moving further away from the Iranian coast rather than closer to it. The United States' European allies are saying that they have no intention of becoming involved in any military operation to open the Strait of Hormuz. Friedrich Merz, Chancellor of Germany, and perhaps in some respects the US's most important ally in Europe, maybe its most outspoken ally in Europe in relation to this particular conflict, the conflict with Iran. Merz is a strong supporter of Israel. He has made no secret of his dislike of the Iranian government. Anyway, he has come out and said that as far as he is concerned, as far as Germany is concerned, the conflict in the Middle East, the conflict with Iran, is not Europe's war, is not Germany's war, and they have no intention of getting involved in it. So the Europeans are refusing to participate, the Japanese are refusing to participate, the Australians are refusing to participate. And we've now seen the first significant resignation from Donald Trump's administration. And Donald Trump himself has now had to ask China for its agreement to a postponement of his trip to China at the end of this month. As I've discussed in several programs, my strong impression is that this trip at the end of this month, which supposedly came out of the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping, which took place in South Korea at the end of last year, that this meeting was actually lobbied for or pressed by Trump himself. Indeed, I got the strong impression that it was actually Trump who basically invited himself to China following this very difficult summit meeting between himself, difficult for him, summit meeting that he had with Xi Jinping in South Korea, where basically the United States had to row back on its tariff and other policies towards China in light of China's restrictions on exports of rare earths. Of course, since then, Trump's position has been undermined further still by the Supreme Court decision, which ruled that his original tariffs were illegal and unconstitutional anyway. So at the moment, as I understand it, China is subjected only to the 10% flat tariff, or is it a 15% flat tariff, that Trump is simultaneously imposing, or the United States is simultaneously imposing on everyone else. Just saying. But anyway, whatever. The fact is that on the American side of the fence, things continue to look, shall we say, complicated and difficult. The allies are not coming to help. The situation with the Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, remains as intractable as ever. The idea of deploying large numbers of ground troops remains deeply controversial and unpopular in the United States, and very high risk as well. So all of these problems are still there, and they continue to mount. Now, before this conflict began, before the United States and Israel launched their attack on Iran, Alex Christoforou and I, on our respective channels and on the Duran, warned that Trump was at great risk of finding himself in Zugzwang. Zugzwang being the situation in chess where a party is obliged to make a move, which, whatever that move is going to put that party in an even worse position than the one he was in previously. And, well, it looked like it was already Zugzwang before the conflict began, in the sense that for Trump not to conduct an attack on Iran would have resulted in significant political damage with Israel, the United States, the neocons in the United States, including some of the people within his administration, and the media supporters of a war against Iran, all furious with Trump. Whereas, of course, pressing forward with the war was likely to put Trump in an even deeper Zugzwang position that he was already in. And to my mind, this is exactly where we are. If things just are allowed to continue in the way that they are, then it seems to me that we're going to see eventually inexorable increases in energy prices. These are already causing stresses on living standards in the United States, and to a much greater extent, by the way, around the world. In Europe, they're starting to create problems. I was reading in the British media this morning that there are apparently the first suggestions that Britain might have to consider energy rationing in a few months' time. I don't know whether that will actually happen, by the way, but anyway, it has been talked about. In a few programmes ago, I actually said that I thought it would be unlikely that we would see energy rationing in Europe, and yet here we are, and it is now apparently being talked about. In Southeast Asia, in the Indian subcontinent, of course, the situation is much worse. It will presumably get worse in other places, in Africa, in South America, wherever. Anyway, we're starting to see increasing pressures in the energy markets, and of course, continuing with the military campaign as it is being conducted at the moment, continues the process of depletion of America's and Israel's already reduced arsenals of air defense interceptors, long-range missiles, and other precision-guided weapons. And apparently, the damage already done to the American radar stations across the Middle East is already enormous and very costly to repair, and likely to take anyway a great deal of time to repair. The alternatives, however, of forcing open the Straits of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is extremely difficult and very, very dangerous. I've been reading all sorts of reports about how if there was an attempt to escort tankers through the Strait of Hormuz, all it would take would be one mine attack or one drone attack on a single tanker, and the crisis would be much worse. In my opinion, what is deterring the US Navy and Western and Japanese navies altogether is not worries about attacks on tankers in the event that they were to send their warships into the Strait of Hormuz to conduct escort operations. Much more serious is potential attacks on the warships themselves and the potential damage to these warships, which would have a very significant political impact, which of course would be greater still depending on how bad the damage to those warships as a result of those attacks might be. So I think it is fear for the warships rather than the tankers that is keeping the Western navies away, just saying. So that option doesn't look an attractive one. And I read somewhere over the last 24 hours that an operation to force open the Strait of Hormuz using ground forces might require a force of around 100,000 men. And, well, that would be a challenging force, challenging number of troops to put together in any short period of time. We're probably looking at months, perhaps even by the end of this year, before a deployment on that kind of scale could take place. And, well, of course, seizing the Strait of Hormuz, making it possible, in theory at least, for tankers to pass through, would only perhaps be the start of the problem, because Iran would still be there, presumably, so long as there is a hostile government in Tehran. There could still be rocket and missile attacks on tankers and ships. There could still be drone attacks on tankers and ships, and the troops trying to keep open the Strait of Hormuz might themselves be subject to long-term attack also. I am not a military expert, and it may be that there are things about this which I do not know, and that there are military solutions to this problem. But they are not obvious to me, and I have not seen any single military official or military expert up to now who has offered any remotely workable solution, or any solution which I see as workable. Whereas attempts to negotiate with the Iranians at this time runs up against the problem that the Iranians themselves don't seem to be interested in negotiations. And if negotiations were to take place, they would happen on a completely different basis than was the case before, with Iran, not Israel or the United States, being in the position of strength and advantage. The president is apparently now becoming increasingly offended by some of the media reporting. He's probably annoyed because reports are appearing in the media that the intelligence community in the United States warned him that an attack on Iran was more likely to strengthen the existing government than to weaken it. There were apparently warnings from the intelligence community that the Strait of Hormuz might indeed be closed, that there might be disruptions in energy markets, that there might be attacks on US regional allies in the Middle East. The president clearly does not want it publicized that he simply ignored all of these warnings and decided to press on regardless. But what we now see is, with an official of the US intelligence community, Joe Kent, now resigning and leaving the administration, it is possible that we might start to see further resignations. And with every person who resigns, the risk for the president increases that these people will start to turn up at the talk shows and will start to give interviews to the media in the United States, which has never liked Donald Trump, and will start to provide further details about the warnings the president was given and which he chose to ignore. So there it is. That's the situation today. Assassinating Larijani doesn't solve anything, as far as I can see. Maybe if he'd been killed in the strike that took place on the first day of the 12-day war in June 2025, it might have been different. But by now, the Iranians have their strategy. They have no obvious reason why they would want to change it. And I'm not sure exactly what it is that the United States is able to do that is going to change it either, or which is going to persuade the Iranians to alter their approach to this war. So it is Zugzwang. Now, of course, and I say this again, it may be the case, it's possibly the case, that the president still knows things that I don't know. I've discussed in my two last programs the importance, the possible importance of General Carney in the lead up to the war, the person who is widely suspected now of having been Mossad's man at the heart of the Iranian leadership. It may be that there are other such people. It may be that there are other pressures that the United States can bring to bear against Iran and the government there that I am not aware of. It could be, for example, that the president and his officials try to do what Richard Nixon did try to do during the Vietnam War. Nixon faced with a similar intractable crisis in Vietnam, tried to put pressure on the Vietnamese by establishing contacts with Vietnam's key allies, the Soviet Union and China, in the hope that these two countries would put pressure on Vietnam to bring the conflict in Vietnam to an end, to enable Nixon to say that he had taken the United States out of that conflict and secured peace with honor, which is of course what he said. Well, the reality was in that case that yes, the Chinese and the Soviets did put a certain amount of pressure on the Vietnamese. That never, however, went so far as to limit arms deliveries to the Vietnamese or economic deliveries to the Vietnamese. It was purely political and diplomatic pressure, which the Vietnamese did pay a certain amount of attention to. But of course, the Soviets and the Chinese, in return for doing that, extracted very significant concessions from the United States, which I have talked about in previous programs. And ultimately, of course, as we all know, the Vietnam War did end, but not with the kind of settlement that Nixon and Kissinger perhaps intended, but with a clear-cut and decisive Vietnamese victory. Well, one should be careful. Events are not going to repeat themselves in the same way. But yes, perhaps the president, perhaps Donald Trump, does have some plan for trying to persuade the Russians and the Chinese to put pressure on Iran. And perhaps, given the fact that these two countries do have leverage over Iran, that might have some success, but of course, doing that will come with a considerable political price, which will inevitably shock the very same people in the United States who propelled a no doubt very willing Donald Trump into this war with Iran in the first place. So there it is. Now, this is a difficult war to anticipate what the eventual outcome will be. It may be that if it goes on, if it stretches on for months or even years, then the continued pounding of Iran that is taking place will eventually cause some kind of a breakdown there. I've received further reports, however, not directly from people in Iran. I'm not in direct contact with anybody in Iran, but with people who have friends and family there, who are, by the way, almost to a person, in fact, I would correct that to a person, very strong critics of the Iranian government. But anyway, all of them are telling me the same thing, that despite the bombing, normal life mostly goes on. Even in Tehran, most of the city so far has been unaffected by the bombing, which tends to be concentrated in a specific area. That the shops continue to be full of goods, that yes, there are economic stresses, the currency situation remains as bad as ever, inflation continues to be a huge problem, but Iranians have up to a point managed to cope with all of this, and so normal life continues, economic activity continues. We are nowhere close in Iran to seeing the sort of breakdown that might lead to a collapse in Iran of the kind that might bring about a rapid end to the war. But perhaps if the pounding goes on long enough, if the Israelis manage to kill even more Iranian officials, then maybe at some point, that will provoke some kind of internal crisis, but I wouldn't count on it. To me, that looks a little bit like magical thinking. Anyway, that is what I see up to this time. Now, anyway, let's move on. I will just quickly add one thing, that as this crisis continues and remains unresolved, as pressures on the global economy grow, and inevitably sooner or later the energy price pressures are also going to start affecting the financial markets and the other commodities markets, and they're going to inevitably lead to falls in industrial output and perhaps consumer consumption, just saying. Anyway, as these economic pressures go, there will be inevitably less and less interest in that other great conflict that is taking place at the present time, which is the conflict in Ukraine. Up to now, in many programs that I have done, I have said that the single biggest, most important geopolitical event that is taking place in the world is the conflict in Ukraine. It has been around the conflict in Ukraine that the entire global geopolitical environment has up to this time been shaped. I am obliged to say this now. Yes, Ukraine, to my mind, remains as important as ever. It continues to shape the geopolitical environment. But it has been overtaken in importance as a crisis by the crisis that we are seeing in the Middle East. And it is a far more intractable crisis than the crisis that the crisis in the Middle East is arguably a much more intractable crisis than the crisis in Ukraine, if only because the Russians have a very, very different approach to the way that conducting this war than the Iranians have. A product of Iran's much weaker position and of Iran's sense that it has far less to lose, and dare I say it, because of the passions that exist whenever there is a conflict in the Middle East. of any kind. Anyway, what is going on in the conflict in Ukraine? Well, the first thing to say is that a Russian official, very senior Russian official, Sergei Lavrov, for example, has now given a further interview over the course of which he has spoken in utterly scathing terms about the Europeans. First of all, I should say that these comments were made over the course of a press conference which Lavrov hosted in Moscow on the occasion of the visit to Moscow of the foreign minister of Kenya. But as always happens when Lavrov gives a press conference, the topics quickly changed. Instead of being focused on relations between Russia and Kenya, important as those are, by the way, they are important, they focus instead shifted obviously to the Middle East and to the situation in Ukraine. I am not going to discuss what Lavrov said about the situation in the Middle East, which is very much in line with what the Russians have also and already been saying. But Lavrov did discuss the situation in Ukraine. And he said some very interesting things. First of all, he confirmed, well, it's not been good, but he didn't confirm. The Russians have for some time confirmed, and now, of course, we know the Europeans have confirmed that Macron sent envoys to Moscow in February, his national security advisor, Mr. Bond, and that they had their meeting with Ushakov, and that this was apparently a disaster. Lavrov said that the Russians were startled to find that the French had absolutely nothing new or original to say, that they were repeating the same talking points that they make in public discussions, that the Russians saw no point in wasting their time with these tiresome people from whom they were hearing the same thing. He did not confirm, despite many reports now that say this, that Ushakov told the French to F off. But effectively, well, he made it, maybe it wasn't quite as coarse as that, or at least Lavrov did not confirm that it was as coarse as that. But the essential points that Lavrov made is that that was basically what happened. Anyway, Lavrov then went on to say that the whole idea of the Europeans becoming involved in the negotiations is absolutely absurd, that they have completely discredited themselves as mediators, and he used those exact words. He said that the Europeans repeatedly betrayed the negotiation process. They purported to broker an agreement between the former president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, who was overthrown in the Maidan events, and his opponents, that within hours of the agreement between Yanukovych and his opponents being reached, that agreement was breached, and so far from standing by that agreement and insisting on implementation of it, the Europeans immediately and enthusiastically supported the forcible change of power. He then went over the whole story, the whole upsetting story of the Minsk Agreement of 2015, which again the Europeans mediated and which was never honoured, and how the Ukrainians have said that they never intended to honour it and that it was an exercise in buying time, and how Merkel and Hollande, who brokered that agreement, knew that all along and aided and abetted the Ukrainians in doing all of that. And Lavrov also dwelt on the role that the Europeans played in sabotaging the April 2022 Istanbul Agreement. And for the first time, he mentioned that it wasn't just Boris Johnson, but other European states as well, that apparently called Zelensky and pressured him to walk away from the agreement that it seemed had been agreed between Russia and Ukraine in Istanbul in April of that year. So Lavrov went through all of that, and he said that these people, they really think that there's any point in them joining in these negotiations or participating in these negotiations. They must be joking. The Financial Times spoke about entreaties from the Europeans to join the negotiations. And, well, Lavrov clearly, and I'm sure here he speaks for the entire Russian government, they're not having any of it. They're not going to let the Europeans in through the door. They think that the only safe place for the Europeans is locked outside. But anyway, those were some of the things that Lavrov said, and he said it in his usual pungent language. But he did say other things. He referred to this idea of deploying European troops to Ukraine in order to enforce a ceasefire, Macron's and Starmer's plan, the coalition of the willing plan and all of that. He referred to such a potential European force as an occupation force. And he said that the reason that the Europeans wanted to do that, and the true reason why the Europeans want to join the negotiations, is because they want to preserve and perpetuate the Kiev regime. And, well, those comments, to my mind, clearly say a number of things. That in Lavrov's own mind, the government in Kiev not only has no legitimacy, but that any force that enters Ukraine, supposedly to enforce a ceasefire, but in effect propping up that illegitimate regime, is by definition an occupation force. And for that reason, it cannot be allowed to be there, not just because it threatens Russia, but because it is occupying and by definition oppressing the people in Ukraine who want to be free of that illegitimate government in Kiev. In other words, Lavrov is saying again that there has to be regime change in Kiev, and he went further than he's ever done. He said that the very existence of what he calls the Kiev regime is a root cause of the war. Now, this is important language because the Russians have repeatedly said that in order for there to be peace in Ukraine and a peaceful settlement of the crisis in Ukraine, the root causes of the war must be addressed. And, well, Lavrov saying that one of those root causes which needs to be addressed is the nature of the regime in Kiev. So the Russians are coming close now, or not coming close, they're now in effect saying that the removal of Zelensky and of the entire government and political structure in Kiev is a precondition for the end of the war. They've come very close to saying this before. In fact, they started to hint at this back in the autumn of 2023, 3 years ago, after the two and a half years ago, after the defeat of Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive. But now they are, in effect, saying it outright, though so far it is not a publicly stated negotiating position. Lavrov always chooses his words very carefully, and I am sure that this language has been coordinated by Putin in advance. I've discussed in recent programs, extending all the way back to December and the Valdai attack on Putin's residence, about how the Russians looked to me to be in the process of hardening their position. And it seems that these comments of Lavrov take that a further step, a step further. So that is one thing. Now, another Russian has also been speaking, and what he's had to say is also extremely interesting. And this is Valery Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff and the overall military commander of the Russian forces who are fighting in the area of the special military operation. Now, Gerasimov started from late summer, early autumn to provide regular updates about the state of the war, something that he had never done before, but he's now doing it, and he's now doing it on a regular basis. And what he had to say is very interesting. But to repeat again a point I've made previously, the fact that that Gerasimov is talking in this way, that he is providing regular briefings about the state of the war, is in itself a clear indication that the Russians are becoming increasingly confident about the way things on the battle lines are going. So anyway, Gerasimov had these things to say, and I'm summarizing it. We have a long account of his comments from the Russian Defense Ministry, but briefly, what Gerasimov said was this. Firstly, in Konstantinovka, he describes a situation that differs markedly from that of the mapping projects, all of the mapping projects that I am aware of. This is not the first time this has happened, by the way. I have long believed that the situation in Konstantinovka is very different from what the mapping projects assume. I think the Russians have been taking a very controlled, have been toughly controlling information from Konstantinovka. But anyway, Gerasimov said that the Russians have broken into Konstantinovka from the northwest, northeast, and the southwest, and that they now control 60% of Konstantinovka, and that they continue to advance there. And the clear impression is that the battle of Konstantinovka has passed its pivot point, and that it is, we're now moving towards a position where the town is going to fall under Russian control. I believe that the Battle of Konstantinovka has been very similar to the battle in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. I think that the Russians have mostly encircled Ukrainian troops in Konstantinovka. I did a program in which I spoke about a cauldron having developed there. It seems to me that Gerasimov's words are consistent with that. I think myself that that is what is happening. He also had some very interesting things to say about the situation in other places. He said that Gneshino has almost fallen to the Russians. In other words, there's still some residual resistance to the Russians there. Gneshino, important village to the northwest of Pokrovsk. He said that most of Liman is now under Russian control. Again, what he has said here is ahead of what the mapping projects are saying. But he says that most of Liman is now under Russian control. He confirmed the capture of various villages around Liman, and he spoke about the Russians being close to capturing Rai Alexandrovka, and we've done programs with Stanislav Kapivnik, and he's explained how the capture of these places gives the Russians the high ground and enables the Russians to create the giant cauldron that they're working towards in Slavyansk, Kramatorsk. We are at the end of the thaw. The thaw has been very fast this year. There continue to be reports of the Russians having taken the offensive in Zaporozhye region. Surprisingly, Gerasimov had very little to say about the Zaporozhye offensive, but it does appear that it's been reactivated. But the big advances, I suspect, are going to happen. The big attacks from the Russians are probably going to happen in April. I think this is the timing. This is when we're going to start to see things begin to move. In the meantime, the Russians see the situation in Europe. They see the Europeans increasingly bewildered at a situation that is spiraling out of their control. They have no control over this conflict in the Middle East. They know that their own military forces are inadequate to fight the Iranians. As Boris Pistorius, the German defense minister, said, the US Navy fears to go. It is unrealistic to imagine that the European navies can go instead. So the Middle East out of control. They are acutely worried about rising energy costs, but they have no control over this issue either. They continue to harass the Russians. They continue to try to seize tankers in the Baltic Sea and look the other way as the Ukrainians conduct attacks on tankers in the Mediterranean. Actually, they're not looking the other way. They are assisting the Ukrainians to conduct attacks on these tankers. Lavrov, another comment that Lavrov said, is that there's been all this talk in Europe about freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, but nothing at all from the people who've been talking about this, about freedom of navigation in the Eastern Mediterranean and in the Baltic, where tankers have been attacked or seized. He is, of course, right, but don't expect that to be reported in the media in the West. Anyway, this harassment of Russian tankers by the Europeans and their Ukrainian allies is not going to meet with much favour around the world. Now, at a time of energy shortages and rising energy costs, I suspect that before long, the administration in Washington, which is already itself under acute political pressure, is going to start to push back against it and is going to tell the Europeans and the Ukrainians to stop. Whether they will pay any attention is, of course, another matter. But anyway, the Europeans have no real strategy. The Americans have lost interest in the negotiations to end the conflict in Ukraine. I discussed all of that in the article in the Financial Times that said all of those things. That same article, by the way, said that the Russians were also frustrated by the negotiations, by, and this is my own take, Trump's failure to deliver on whatever it was he promised in Anchorage, and that the Russians are losing interest in the negotiations themselves, as, by the way, they have all but said. So, and the Europeans know that without the United States, they can't keep on arming Ukraine. And they also know that with the high energy costs, their ability to pressure the Russians economically, which was never very straight, gone, that's all melted away also. Meanwhile, the IMF is now again warning about major financing problems faced by Zelensky and by the government in Kiev. And the Europeans have also now discovered that the Russians are not interested in talking to them. The Russians instead are now talking about regime change in Kiev. It's impossible to interpret Lavrov's words any other way. And Putin, for his part, is remaining silent. Well, who can doubt in this situation, especially given that Zelensky continues to oppose all concessions, that we're going to see a military end to this war? Anyway, that's where I'm going to finish today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.